From KQED and the California Report, this is Capitol Notes, a weekly roundup of California politics from the state capitol in Sacramento.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Capitol Notes podcast for the last day of November.
This is it.
This is it. This is the last day.
It's all December from here on out.
Time flies when you're having fun. I'm John Myers from KQED and the California Report. Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, here with me in our studios across the street from the state capitol, pondering where the month of November has gone.
It's a blur.
It is a blur, isn't it? And I think it's like a blur because it's just been a little dull around here, has it not?
It's a blur of turkey and big five meetings and deals falling apart and floor sessions called and canceled, or excuse me, not canceled, but
don't get in trouble there.
Right, because floor sessions are never canceled. They're only postponed.
Suffice it to say, I think if anybody is a follower of California politics, it has been an awfully quiet period. There has not been a lot of news, which, as a reporter, it's kind of tough. It's like you would think sometimes we would like the calmer schedule, but at the same time, it's almost frustrating then because there's really just not a whole lot to report about.
Well, it is, and people are hunkered down now. You know, I think legislators are sort of huddling, not only on the special sessions that are ongoing with water and healthcare, such as they are, starting to look past those a little bit towards the budget. You know, there was a hearing this week on the state of the budget, which has a $10 billion hole in it. And then in January here, we're going to start seeing bills move again. The bills from last year that were stalled in committees, and legislators are going to be coming up with their new bill ideas.
Well, let's before we go that far, I mean, let's just update folks on the fact that healthcare and water are still they're still going. They're not officially dead. There are no real exciting life signs probably on either issue. I'd say probably it would be fair to say water has been more publicly said as probably not going to happen this year. The pro tem of the Senate, Don Parada, pretty much said he was looking toward next year. Recently, healthcare, nobody has quite said that yet.
Well, the timelines on the two are different. The idea was to get a water bond on the February ballot. This healthcare deal was supposed to be cut in time to put something on the November ballot. So those are completely different timelines. The deadline to get information into the to get something on the ballot so that the Secretary of State would have time to print the arguments for and against it and the supplemental ballot pamphlet, that's quickly running out here. So that's probably why the water conversation feels more dead, because it had the earlier timeline.
In which case, healthcare, you know, has got that time. Although it you know, every time you try to take the pulse of what's going on with those negotiations, you just kind of get the sense that the more they reach toward compromise, the more they end up pissing somebody else off.
Yeah, well, it's a problem that the speaker really wants a deal. He's made that clear from the beginning. He has gotten involved in this very heavily. The speaker has been taking the lead in the legislature on trying to negotiate a deal. And I think he wants a deal in part because he thinks it might help the governor's perspective on Proposition 93, the change in the state term limits law. But I think he also genuinely wants to do something. Mm-hmm. He's coming up. If Prop 93 does not pass, this will be his last year as speaker, and it's kind of a legacy thing. That said, you know, the speaker seems to be moving toward the governor in hopes of getting a deal on things like the individual mandate, forcing everybody to have health care. And in terms of the pay structure of who would pay for it, moving towards the speaker, and in the process, losing support from his core, from labor unions. There's some, including SEIU, the service workers, who have been strongly behind the speaker, and now seems to be some internal fighting there over the health care deal.
I think I described it the last time we sat here doing a podcast on this as, you know, you wonder what the elasticity factor is. You wonder how far you can stretch the Speaker Nunez's side and the governor's side to the middle. Is there enough elasticity there, or, you know, does the whole thing snap and break, you know, trying to find that middle ground?
It feels at this point that the unions have stretched about as far as they're willing to go. And you know, keep in mind that regardless of what deal gets cut, Blue Cross is sitting out there getting ready to blow it out of the water on the November ballot. they stretch any, and if and there are sort of the fringe elements that are the core supporters of single payer or nothing, including the Nurses Association, who will probably oppose whatever deal is cut. But you have sort of mainstream labor. If you lose mainstream labor, the initiative's dead. Then nobody's going to take ownership of this thing to get it passed in November.
Yeah.
And a $10 billion hole in the budget doesn't help.
Well, let's talk about that, because that did come up this week. You know, there was another discussion where the legislative analyst Elizabeth Hill presented her findings that she rolled out for the media a couple of weeks ago, presented them to the Senate Budget Committee. And it was an informational hearing, but, you know, I think, as you know, if you're a budget watcher, it's interesting at least to watch what the lawmakers' questions are, what their reaction to Hill's analysis is. And right, as she's been saying, it looks like we've got a $2 billion hole in the existing current year budget.
Correct.
And about $8 billion in the coming year budget, so about $10 billion in red ink. And there was this entire little side drama, which actually became the only drama, because let's face it, there's not a lot of news, right, about legislative Republicans and a fiscal emergency.
Right.
Bob Dutton, the Republican from Rancho Cucamonga, state senator, was querying Liz Hill several times about are we under a fiscal emergency as defined by Proposition 58, the ballot measure that voters passed a few years back that gave the governor the power to declare a fiscal emergency.
Right.
And there was a real back and forth, and we both know Liz Hill is a very cautious budget analyst.
Yes.
She is not going to make large prognostications, you know, that have some kind of opinion-based. She's very fact-based.
Right.
And so she hedged her bets, but you could see kind of where Republicans want to go. They think this is enough of a crisis to force the governor, that they don't feel always as a Republican, to act.
Right. Well, and what the fiscal emergency would do under the provision in Proposition 58, it would force the governor to cut a deal with the legislature to make cuts or to fix the hole in the budget, whether it's through increased revenues, a tax increase, mm-hmm, or budget cuts. And it would basically shut the legislature down for all business until they cut a deal.
If they were unable to do it within 45 days.
Right.
Yeah, then they could act on no other legislation, no other issues until they dealt with it. Right.
So, it, you know, the governor, I don't, certainly no Democrats in the legislature want that. Everybody has their legislative agenda. The governor is about to unveil his new agenda for the year in the State of the State address. And I'm sure that this will be a big part of the discussion. You know, I don't think the governor wants to be put in that box. You know, there's something political here. This hearing this week was filled with loud choruses of "I told you so" from the Republican caucus. And, you know, I think that they're just sort of taking their political stance, staking out their position for the new year.
Yeah. And I found it interesting that, you know, the deputy director of the Department of Finance, which is the Department of Finance, for those of you who don't know, that basically works for the governor. I call them the governor's budget team.
Yeah.
The deputy director was testifying at the hearing and said, you know, said it right out there, said there is a fair amount of debate within the administration about what constitutes a fiscal emergency and
right,
whether, you know, what is the trigger under Prop 58 that the governor should act. Because if you read Prop 58, as I think we've kind of alluded to here, if I didn't say it already, It leaves the discretion to the governor as to
right,
what constitutes a fiscal emergency. You know, it says something like significant drop in revenues or significant
right,
rise in expenditures. Well, what's significant?
And these triggers are arbitrary. I mean, remember the whole deal with the car tax when Gray Davis tried to rescind the cut in the car tax. That was a trigger, supposedly an automatic trigger that was pulled based on Department of Finance numbers. Now,
which we know now was totally not automatic. Davis almost said it at the press club a couple of weeks ago, where he said,
right,
"When I raised the car tax," that doesn't sound like an automatic trigger.
Right.
But he tried to call it one. I remember that. You're absolutely right.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's that these trigger mechanisms are meant as protections, but mm-hmm, oftentimes they're just as political and just as malleable as anything else in this business.
You know what I was struck by just quickly on the Prop 58 thing is, you remember when Prop 57 and 58 were negotiated. This was
right,
the first big Arnold Schwarzenegger deal as
2004,
governor. He came right, into office end of 2003. Let's get it on the March 2004 ballot. Let's refinance the debt that was racked up under the Davis administration.
Right.
And then let's come up with a balanced budget protection, or a way
right,
to make sure this never happens again. And 58... if my memory is right, and you'll have to see if I've lost it here or not, but 58 was kind of the compromise version of a balanced budget. Republicans right. wanted something much more strict, and they wanted some more ability to cut and more ways to declare things. And the price for getting those deficit bonds on the ballot that Democrats demanded was a weaker Prop 58.
Right.
And so here we are back where Prop 58 clearly doesn't have any real teeth.
Right. And that was the knock on it at the time, that it was mm-hmm. basically window dressing to get voters to run up the credit card bill. I mean,
right.
that was the knock against Prop 58 from conservatives from the beginning. Honestly, I'm not sure what provisions of Prop 58 have ever been enacted.
Well, we've done the budget reserves. We've done the
right.
reserve requirements. But other than that,
right.
I mean, it's been pretty darn thin.
You've got a $4 billion reserve this year, which has suddenly evaporated into a $2 billion hole.
Yeah.
So, again, the malleability of some of these things.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to watch the finance people said at the hearing that December 10th is when they expect to get a whole new set of data in about the status of the California economy. You know, we'll find out more about the real estate market. We'll find out more about property taxes, which have a big impact, you know, a number of factors.
Right.
And I'm watching for that date to come and that data to come in and legislative Republicans to start beating the drums louder on this issue. And I
yeah.
do think at a certain point it's going to be difficult for the governor to ignore it completely. I mean, we haven't gotten to ask him the question yet, but I think at a certain point he's going to have to figure out what's the answer to the question. If this is not a physical emergency, why?
Right.
And what is one?
Right. And, you know, and it's hard not to pick up. I mean, just walk in the halls of the Capitol now. There certainly is a kind of pervasive malaise over there.
That's nice. Pervasive malaise.
Yeah, yeah. I was in the shower. That phrase came to
pervasive malaise.
Right.
It's a great phrase.
But it's, you know, it's undeniable over there. You know, as these water and healthcare deals begin to apparently fall apart and people are, you know, wrestling with a $10 billion budget deficit, this is not the fun time to be an elected official. I mean, this is, you know, there's going to be a lot of pain. They're going to make real cuts, have to make real cuts to the state budget that are going to affect real people in real ways. And it's going to be difficult. I think that there's going to be a lot of anger in the next couple of months here as they try to deal with this problem.
Well, and then let's talk politics, just regular old, bare-knuckle politics then, because all of this is going to start to gel and really come home and be blasted across newspaper headlines and on television and radio right when this campaign reaches its climax for Proposition 93. I mean, let's
right.
just be honest about Proposition 93, which would extend the length of time in office of the current leadership of the legislature. It would reduce total amount of time people could serve in the legislature, but
right.
it would provide an exception for a lot of incumbents. That whole campaign is going to reach this climax about trust us to do this a certain way
right.
while the budget and everything is going to pot.
Right, and the opponents of Proposition 93 are trying to frame this initiative as a referendum on the current legislative leadership,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, the legislature, I don't think people pay it. The one thing most people know about the legislature is that they don't pass the budget on time. I mean, honestly, the amount of civic engagement in state politics is
pretty low.
Is very low. And you know, people generally don't like politicians. I mean, I think times are tough now. You look at what's going on nationally and certainly in the state with the lending crisis, the subprime mortgage stuff, and the economic slowdown, high energy prices. People aren't happy. I mean, there's talk of heading into a recession, and politicians take the brunt of this stuff. So if the opponents of Prop 93 are successful in framing this debate as a referendum on the current leadership, then, I think conventional wisdom up here is that the proponents of it are going to have a hard time convincing voters to get it approved.
There's been some skirmishing on Prop 93 in the last few days, and I would really only call it, I think it to be fair, skirmishing.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, these are not huge news stories, with all due respect to the Yes on 93 campaign, who's seen some of it as a larger narrative. But
right.
there was this whole discussion this week about how the No on 93 campaign is not doing what it should to disclose where all of its money's come from. And
right.
it comes back to a figure who we've talked about a lot in recent times, a New York real estate developer named Howard Rich,
right.
who gave some seed money to the No on 93 campaign. And now Steve Poizner, the insurance commissioner, who is ostensibly the face and front man for the No
right.
on 93 campaign, is being asked to force Rich to say where his money comes from.
Well,
or not just Rich,
the
but
issue
the
is that
term
Rich,
limits group.
Rich is a...
Right.
a member of the board of an organization called U.S. Term Limits, which is a nonprofit organization.
I shorthanded it too much.
Yeah. U.S. Term Limits, the organization, gave $1.5 million to the No on 93 campaign. But U.S. Term Limits itself, under the federal tax code, nonprofits do not have to disclose where their donations come from. So the proponents are trying to allege some sort of money laundering or nefarious activity by on a lack of disclosure of where the money is coming from for the No on 93 campaign. You know, again, I think you're right. It's a skirmish. It's a way to, you know, to raise some dust over this issue, whether it helps pass Proposition 93. I mean, remember, this is not a no campaign. This is a yes campaign. I mean, does it really – if you – are you going to vote for something just because you know Howard Rich is opposed to it? I mean, I don't think most voters know who Howard Rich is. I'm not sure that that is the enough to get Proposition 93 passed. I'm sure the people running that campaign are certainly a lot smarter than I am about this stuff, and I'm sure that they'll start talking about the merits soon.
But. Yeah, but let's just put it right down to real basic politics 101, money. Right. And you know, whoever's got enough money most times, not always, most times wins the day. If they can get their because they can get their message out in California much more effectively than people who don't have their money. I guess what I was going to say is, if the No on 93 folks can get enough money here, then we've got trouble. If Poizner actually opens his wallet, which is the great unknown still, right? I mean, how much will he open his wallet to finance No on 93 ads and things, right?
Well, I think on this issue of term limits, you know, we've seen before that it's not just about money. Remember, there was, I think it was Proposition 45. Back when I was back in what 2000, 98, whenever it was to extend term limits. There was an initiative on the ballot to extend term limits outright, and that measure was proponents of that measure outspent the opponents 10-1. But voters have such an emotional attachment to term limits that I'm not sure that the opponents even need to match the proponents dollar for dollar.
I think you're right, except the fact that this one in its early read looks like a term limits reduction.
Because of the
title and summary looks like a term limits reduction. Right. And it is for future members of the legislature. I mean, it's not inaccurate
and
in that way. And for some current, it's not right. It's not inaccurate that way.
Right.
And the early polling has shown that that's what the voters are buying.
Right.
So I guess what I'm saying is that's why I'm somewhat skeptical that the no's could just win the day by people loving term limits. Because I think here they've got to be able to educate the voter to say this is not just a reduction in time in office.
Absolutely. I mean, and that was always the question up here. I mean, I think given what the Attorney General's title and summary that will actually appear on the ballot, the description of the initiative when voters go into the booth or sit at their kitchen table and vote, as we're seeing more of.
Yeah, as we found out this week, right? Yeah. A lot of mail ballots.
Right. There has been a lot of confusion. You know, Republicans in early polls, Republicans who are traditionally proponents of term limits have been in the polls have shown them supportive of 93 because there seems to be some confusion about what the measure does. And I think that was the question here about whether there would be money for a no campaign on 93 to get that message out that you're talking about. Now, Poizner has made it clear that there will be. Mm-hmm. You know, there's $3 million in the account now. You know, whether that'll be – that might be enough. You know, and if not, Steve Poizner's worth $19 zillion. So, I mean, if he – you know, as he accrues interest, even though our interest rates might be lower, I think they're still high enough where that Steve Poizner will be able to bankroll this No on 93 campaign. And something tells me he might be starring in some of these campaign ads as he gets his face out there for
just slightly might help his statewide visibility in case he chooses to run for governor in 2010.
You think?
So since term limits, term limits is up in the air, shall we say, just to be fair, who knows whether the initiative will pass or not. You took some time over at Capital Weekly this week to ponder what might happen if there's a new Speaker of the Assembly, if the modification doesn't pass and Speaker Nunez is termed out next year. Who might be the new top dog?
Well, that's a good question, and funny you should ask.
funny transition after reading your fine newspaper.
CapitalWeekly.net. Capital with an O. Basically, I mean, in February, if Prop 93 does not pass, three of the four legislative leaders will be lame ducks, essentially. Dick Akerman, Fabian Nunez, and Don Parada are all scheduled to be termed out.
Mike Valines is left. He's king.
Yeah, anyway. Lucky him. Two more years of fun and majesty in the, as he is Assembly Republican leader.
In the midst of a multi-billion-dollar deficit. Good anyway.
Times. But, you know, despite the economic condition of the state, I think there are no shortage of people who want to succeed the speaker. And that discussion is beginning in the Capitol now, and I'm sure we'll get louder and louder as February 5th approaches here.
So let's talk about who's on the list. Who'd you put on the list?
The top of our list, we put Karen Bass, the Assembly Majority Leader, I'm not sure what her exact title is.
Democrat of Los Angeles.
Democrat from Los Angeles, was elected with strong labor support in a crowded field and down in the Culver City area.
Does she have enough time left in office on the term limits to make her a viable candidate for speaker?
That's the question. You know, it's whether they go back to the old model of the speaker, picking the sophomore speaker who will be in office for 2 years or 18 months, or whether they do as they did this time with Fabian Nunez and pick a member of the freshman class. Now, Nunez was an exception. He had remarkable political skill. He learned at the hand of Miguel Contreras, the late head of the Los Angeles County Labor Federation. And arguably, there are not any freshmen this year that really have the political seasoning and the familiarity with Sacramento that Nunez had as a freshman. That said, you know, I think you can look at the Nunez speakership and see that there has been sort of a shift of power back to the Assembly vis-a-vis the Senate a little bit. And given where it was with, you know, when say Cruz Bustamante was speaker and Bill Lockyer was pro tem.
You made a, you know, in looking at your list, which we'll tell people we'll put up on the site here so they can see the whole list themselves. You know, you in looking at the list that you put together, I mean, clearly we see that it's still the odds-on favorite that a Southern California Democrat becomes Assembly Speaker. I mean, that's been kind of the way it's been in the post-Willie Brown era, mostly.
Since Willie Brown, every Democratic leader, including Richard Katz, who was the minority leader when Republicans briefly held control, every Democratic leader in the Assembly has been from Southern California or Latino or both.
I was going to say, because Bustamante was from Central Valley, from
Dinuba, the man from Dinuba. But every other leader, Antonio Villaraigosa, Bob Hertzberg, Herb Wesson, Fabian Nunez, Richard Katz, all from Los Angeles. And there's sort of been this informal where the Senate is run by a Northern Californian and the Assembly by a Southern Californian.
Of course, that could flip if Alex Padilla, Democrat of Los Angeles, really wanted to be the pro tem of the Senate.
Really wanted to be or was really able to be.
Well, okay, that remains to be seen.
That's another podcast.
Right, exactly. That's another podcast. But if he was able to be, you know, you could flip the two. But there's been an informal agreement, suffice it to say, that you would split the state
in
the two chambers.
Right. And there are some geographic issues, as we saw this week with the Transportation Commission, and money does get doled out regionally. But the strongest candidates, you know, the people that we put at the top of our list, Karen Bass from Los Angeles and Hector De La Torre from Southgate, who meets the both of the criteria of being both from Southern California and Latino.
And you had one member from the Bay Area, from the East Bay, from Fremont.
Right, Alberto Tirico, the chairman of the Governmental Organization Committee, who, you know, he's an impressive fundraiser. You know, I think some people have speculated that he is interested in the job. Whether, you know, how viable he is as a candidate, you know, remains to be seen. And this list is in flux.
I was also fascinated by another person you put on the list, Charles Calderon.
Yeah.
A Democratic Assemblyman from Southern California.
Who
most notably in California political history for political junkies was a member of the Gang of Five, when he was originally in the legislature trying to dethrone. It's a Friday morning. Yeah. Willie Brown.
Right. Charles Calderon was in the Assembly before term limits was passed in 1990. I think he was elected in 82, and he ran for speaker. He was the head of the Gang of Five that included Gary Condit.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Condit, Calderon, Jerry Eves, Rusty Arias, and who are we missing? Steve Peace.
Wow.
Steve Peace.
Nice. Bravo.
Yeah,
well done.
But, you know, he's expressed interest, and Calderon, these five Democrats tried to get together with Assembly Republicans to make Calderon the speaker. And remember, it's 41 votes to become a majority of the House. It's not a majority of the Democratic caucus to become the speaker. So, you know, Calderon is experienced. He's not a true freshman. He's a super red shirt freshman. He's got a lot of legislative experience. He's a moderate. He is Latino. He's got good working relationships with business groups and with Republicans. And if Republicans do want to play and there are 10 moderate Democrats interested, hey, why not?
And last but not least on that list, number five, halfway in the list, right in the middle, Fabian Nunez.
Right, because if Prop 93 does pass, then, you know, odds are we're looking at 4 to 6 more years of Speaker Nunez.
Why 4 to 6?
Well, you know,
why not 6?
Well, when you get towards the end, well, first of all, you never know what's going to happen. But you know what other political offices may open if certain people run for governor, other people might run for mayor. Who knows? Mm. He would have up to 6 more years of eligibility. Could put it that way,
It's not to say that the leadership, the solidity of leadership in the state Senate wouldn't also be interesting, because Don Parada would be eligible for another 4 years in office if Prop 93 passed.
Correct.
But, I mean, clearly, if you just look at the assembly, would be the – if that played out, I mean, I think people would go back and examine, you know, a speakership that was, you know, the longest since Willie Brown, and also, you know, what kinds of dynamic things happen, what happened, you know, how that whole thing played out. I mean, it really would be something to watch.
Well, longevity and familiarity have a way of breeding enemies, too. You know, I mean, just because he's eligible for the job for 6 more years and just because it doesn't mean he could necessarily hold on as speaker. Now, there's been no indication that anyone is interested in, you know, publicly interested in overthrowing the speaker now. Would it be different if, you know, say 4 years from now, if he was still the speaker? Who knows? I mean, these are hypotheticals that not even we podcasters can accurately envision.
We're just not
clairvoyant
enough.
Wow.
Thank you.
See, nice. I knew you were going to say that.
Before we wrap this thing up, I want to just something we did a couple of weeks ago. We did a podcast. You're still shaking your head over there.
I just nervous tick.
Nervous tick. Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, when we last did a podcast here in the studio, we were talking about. I asked, you know, what was coming up in the next week that, you know, people were looking at, and our friend Jordan Rowell was talking about whatever he was talking about. But I want to throw one in there. We'll get Jordan back someday. Jordan's good. But I was just going to throw one in that I think is worth watching if you're interested in politics. And the national political scene continues to watch this one. And I, you know, keep getting queries from the NPR folks and others from around the country about this, which is the Electoral College Initiative, because they are under the gun to get their signatures submitted to get that initiative on the June 2008 ballot, that initiative that would allow a fragmenting of Electoral College votes in California to go to one party or the other, not all winner take all anymore. They're under a pretty tight deadline. Their consultant, Dave Gilliard, says they're still on track to get them, and you know, and they've got some money out there. We think it's kind of hard to see. I mean,
right. There's been a lot of speculation about whether or not there was a talk a couple of weeks ago. They were pulling signature gatherers off the streets, that they were running out of money. That Daryl Issa, the Congressman Daryl Issa, big backer of the recall, has adopted this initiative as well. And
there was a lot of talk from Democrats about the way the signature gatherers were mysteriously, surreptitiously trying to get signatures on the initiative. So.
Right, but they'll have to submit. I think it's by the 5th, right? Is it next week?
It's coming up. Well, I mean, the date unfortunately is not. Yeah, I mean, the formal date. Yes, the formal date is. You're right. Actually, is coming. Is next
to start
week.
Submitting the process of submitting the signatures to the counties.
Yeah, there was an informal date before that, which clearly they didn't make. But you know, right? It still can get on the ballot, and if it gets on the ballot. I mean, it's a huge fight.
Right. If nothing else, it's sort of like the Indian Gaming Complex that'll be on the ballot in February. Look, just their existence on the ballot, whether or not there's money for a campaign on the other side, Democrats are going to have to spend a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money to kill that thing.
Yeah. Do you realize that I said at the beginning of this podcast there wasn't anything going on, and we've been going for 28 minutes now?
Our ability to ramble is about nothing is impressive.
I was going to say something similar. Like, it's almost like when there's less going on, there's more of a need to talk. We'll ponder that one until next time. I'm leaving Anthony pondering that one.
I'm speechless.
For a change, you and me both. That'll do it for this edition, folks. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED and the California Report. We'll see you next time.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.